From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Photojournalist Susan Mysalis risked her life taking pictures of the Sandinista Revolution. She recently went back to Nicaragua looking for the people she photographed to find out how their lives had changed. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mysalis about taking pictures during revolution and war. Also today, screenwriter and director Paul Schrader talks with us about his movie The Comfort of Strangers, which is now out on video. Schrader wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, and he directed American Gigolo and Patty Hearst. And Soviet emigre David Gurevich says goodbye to Gorbachev. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal appeals court ruled today that the Bush administration can send thousands of Haitian boat people back to their homeland. The United States is holding about 7,500 Haitians who were intercepted by the Coast Guard or the Navy as they attempted to escape Haiti in small boats. The Bush administration was prevented from returning them by a federal judge in Miami, who issued a preliminary injunction at the request of a Haitian refugee group. The administration has granted asylum to about 215 Haitians, but argued that most of the refugees were leaving because of economic rather than political reasons. According to a spokesman for Russian President Boris Yeltsin, President Gorbachev and Yeltsin agreed today to end the existence of the Soviet government on New Year's Eve. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Both the Soviet news agency TASS and the independent news service Interfax are reporting that in a meeting in the Kremlin today, Yeltsin and Gorbachev agreed that all Soviet institutions would cease operation by the end of the year. On New Year's Eve, Yeltsin's spokesman is quoted as saying, the red Soviet flag would be lowered over the Kremlin, leaving only the Russian flag flying above the traditional seat of power here. At that point, the Russian government would take over the Kremlin and thus become the inheritor of the power of the Soviet state. The question of Gorbachev's resignation has still not been resolved. In a briefing today, Gorbachev's spokesman declined to discuss his resignation. He did say that Gorbachev would not accept a post that is purely ceremonial in the Commonwealth of Independent States that will replace the Soviet Union. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Israeli Air Force jets bombed a suspected Palestinian guerrilla base in South Lebanon today. Israel says the area was used as a base for staging terrorist attacks. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
It was the first Israeli attack on South Lebanon in a month. Military sources said that Israeli jets bombed a base of the pro-Syrian radical Palestinian group led by Ahmed Jibril. Reports from Beirut said that six people were injured. In the past, Israel has repeatedly bombed targets in South Lebanon. But today's raid was different because the target was in the Syrian-controlled Bekaa Valley near the town of Sultan Yaqub. This is the area where three Israeli servicemen were captured after a Syrian tank battle in 1982. There has been no information on the three since then. Some Israeli analysts speculated the raid could be in retaliation for Syria's vote yesterday against repealing the UN's Zionism is Racism resolution. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street as traders reacted to news of a decline in new housing starts, and the Federal Reserve gave no sign of further reductions in interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 17 points to close at 2,902. Declines led advances by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 191 million shares. This is NPR. A delegation of officials from the Khmer Rouge rebel faction arrived today in Phnom Penh, the capital of Cambodia. They were the first representatives of the radical Maoist group to return since a top Khmer Rouge official was nearly lynched last month. The Khmer Rouge are hated by many people in the country because their regime killed hundreds of thousands of Cambodians when it held power in the 1970s. The Khmer Rouge still command one of the largest rebel armies, though, and their participation is regarded as essential to peace in Cambodia. The interim governing council is expected to hold talks as soon as the top Khmer Rouge officials return. Officials in Palatka, Florida, are still searching for the cause of an Amtrak train derailment this morning. Dave Pignanelli reports that dozens were injured when the train jumped its tracks.
The Amtrak train was on a run from New York to Tampa this morning when it suddenly derailed just south of Jacksonville. Officials say the train hit a nearby house, but no one was reportedly inside the dwelling at the time. The train was carrying 170 passengers and 16 crew members. Palatka Community Hospital spokeswoman Abby Stivender says many were treated for cuts and bruises.
So far, we've seen 26 people. They've all been minor injuries.
Four others with more serious injuries were airlifted to hospitals in Jacksonville and Gainesville for treatment. Today's mishap was the fourth time that a train has derailed in Florida within the last 2 weeks. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Syrian President Hafez al-Assad pardoned almost 3,000 political prisoners today in an apparent bid to improve his government's image on human rights. The prisoners were described as having committed acts against the state's security. Syria has been under pressure from the West to improve its human rights practices, which have been condemned by organizations like Amnesty International. Diplomatic sources in Damascus say the Syrian government has been quietly releasing prisoners for months, including some who are apparently political prisoners. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Susan Micellus spent more than a decade in Central America photographing life under dictatorships and life during war and revolution. She risked her own life many times to get the picture. Her photographs have been on the covers of news magazines, as well as on the walls of museums. She's considered by many to be the photojournalist who best captured the story of the Sandinista Revolution. Those photographs are collected in her book, Nicaragua. She recently returned to Nicaragua to track down some of the people she photographed during the insurrection against the Somoza regime, to find out how their lives were changed by the Sandinista victory and the long Contra War. It's the subject of her new documentary film, Pictures from a Revolution, co-directed with Richard Rogers and Alfred Guzzetti. Micellus told me why she first went to Nicaragua in 1978.
It's a combination of things. I really read about Nicaragua in the New York Times. It was a place I hadn't heard of. It was a history I knew nothing of. That provoked the first curiosity, and what I was reading about was people challenging a dictatorship and believing that it was an unjust society. Again, the issue of Somoza owning 25% of the country was quite well documented. I think probably what drew me was a sense of people coming together to try and make a change. It wasn't clear at the time, though, of course, in retrospect, it seems so obvious that it would lead to either an armed struggle or a revolution of the scale that took place.
What were some of the lessons that you learned early on about how to photograph under fire, or how to photograph when you knew you could be a target?
I think I probably learned the way most of us did. We learned by watching the others who maybe had been through something similar before, though every war has its own particularities. I remember as the war developed, obviously many journalists came, both television crews as well as other print and photographic journalists. And I remember talking with a TV cameraman who'd covered Vietnam, and he talked about zigzagging down the streets. The people in Vietnam, however, had never been in a war in which it was fought in an urban environment where the rebels and the soldiers would be within blocks of each other. So that would be new for them, that they never crossed the line in the same way. They never went to North and South Vietnam, as you know. But people who had been in Beirut certainly were accustomed to that. In their case, it was more that the sides were never so clear as they were in Central America. So one learns by doing, as always. No one can really tell you how to do it. And whatever you've known or learned from the past is going to be different in the future, because Nicaragua was nothing like what I came to see and live through in El Salvador, which was much more brutal.
Were there a set of rules that you would follow when you were taking photographs during house-to-house fighting or fighting in the streets?
There are no written rules, Terry. There's really a feeling of trusting your own intuition, and if it doesn't feel good, feeling that that's okay not to go forward, and some people do, and some people fall behind, and you have to completely Allow yourself to be in touch with your own feelings. I think the most dangerous part of doing this kind of work is assuming that you need to go further than you're emotionally prepared for. Sometimes led by other journalists who may have whatever sets of reasons. Sometimes the scoop mentality, which leads people into very, very dangerous circumstances that they're not able to handle emotionally. I remember very well when a friend of ours was killed in El Salvador, John Hoagland. And John had been in El Salvador for many years and had probably crossed more lines of fire than anyone. And when he was killed, people were just stunned. And yet the next day at 5 a.m, a whole group of men basically got in cars and drove out into the war once again. And I didn't get into the car. And I remember first feeling, what's wrong? I'm a woman. What's wrong with me? I'm not tough enough. And then I guess somewhere I felt I had to live with who I was, whether it was because I was a woman or I simply felt what I felt about John and didn't want to be out there at that time. I think those are very difficult moments because there's so much competition under these circumstances that one can be led for precisely the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm. How long did that feeling last that you didn't want to go out there?
Several days.
It's not really a very long time. Might have felt like it.
It feels like a very long time. But there was another period of time that I didn't go back after and I was in a very nasty mine explosion, which another friend who was driving the car beside me. At this time, I was actually traveling with John. He was in the back seat. I was in the front seat of a car, and a Claymore mine exploded and eventually killed the man that was driving the car. He was in a coma for a long period of time before his death. And it was on a side dirt road, and it was sufficiently powerful as a... I think in a way mines are very different than gunfire because they create a kind of paranoia of anywhere, at any time, in an unpredictable fashion, one can be attacked in a sense, which is very different than being on a street, as you can imagine, seeing or hearing the weapons that are on the other side. And that stopped me for a year from going back to El Salvador. I think that whether it's days or a year, it takes a lot of healing or building of barricades internally to do the kind of work and to see what we've seen, to witness the cruelty and that many, many of us have somehow absorbed into our lives.
Do you think that it was harder for you in a way to have these, a short and a long period of not wanting to go back into a dangerous situation? Harder for you because perhaps as a woman you felt more strongly that you had to prove your courage, that you had to prove that, you know, being a woman photojournalist didn't mean that you are going to be any less courageous than your male counterparts.
I'm sure there's an element of that. But I think the hardest thing is that the business is so driven by a competitive edge and there's so little commitment to the particular vision a particular photographer might have in a particular place. But instead, it's a kind of feeling of a business that treats people as if they're replaceable. And of course, on some level, we all are, but in a sense, that if it's only a kind of sense of the automatic response, it's really not very interesting, ultimately, to certainly myself. I am who I am. I grew up when I did, whether I be a woman or, you know, these are factors that obviously are at play, but I think the the most difficult thing is really to be in a world which doesn't value the vision of a particular person as much as one would hope.
If you're just joining us, my guest is photojournalist Susan Micellis, and she spent over a decade in Central America documenting life under war, revolution, dictatorship. There are several books of her work. She's had many museum shows. Her work's been on the cover of the news magazines. And now she has a new movie about her return to Nicaragua 10 years after the insurrection, and that's called Pictures from a Revolution. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photojournalist Susan Micellis. Can you tell us the story of a picture that you took a great risk to get because you thought the image would be an important one?
I mean, there's so many pictures that come from taking different levels of risks. There's a picture that's actually referred to in the film, but just by another image, of the yellow bus and a group of people holding up their arms in front of the yellow bus. And if you see the photograph, perhaps even out of the context of the book, I'm not sure what meaning it has. But everybody being pulled off of a bus is a very common event, probably throughout Latin America and different countries more than others, but certainly Nicaragua, El Salvador, Colombia, in areas of conflict, everyone is potentially the enemy. And so the army ritually searches buses or cars looking for messages or people carrying medicine or any evidence that they might be armed or supporting the people who are armed in a region. So that group of people at that time in Nicaragua were pulled off of a bus, and a man with a pistol is just behind me searching, watching the search. And I was in a car. He didn't pull me out of my car. He looked through the car. And as he turned and all of the people were asked to turn their backs to they're facing the bus, I took a photograph. And that second, I had as much doubt as I might have had in any number of other moments as to whether or not he would approve, he would accept, in fact, the fact that that click would make an image that would be remembered in some fashion. I didn't know if he was going to shoot people right then and there off the bus. In El Salvador, I saw that happen. I know that that has happened at times that none of us have seen.
What happened after you clicked the camera when people were taken off the bus?
I don't think he noticed.
You don't think he heard the click?
I don't think he heard the click. I don't know what he might have done. He was certainly in close enough range to have heard the click. I think not hearing the click may be more a factor of his own obsession with the people that had just been taken off the bus. He was sufficiently engaged in that activity that what I was doing was secondary, or he may not have thought what I was doing mattered. Certainly in El Salvador, we saw much evidence of that. The book, El Salvador, Work of 30 Photographers, there are many images that are shocking just because they were made, that you have to ask, how is it possible that the men in this photograph allowed the photographer to make this image at that time? There's an acknowledgement in a strange way that it's as if they're, you know, holding up the deers they've shot in the woods, you know, proudly when they're showing mutilated bodies below them. It's something that I've never really been able to understand. Either they don't see that the photograph has power as it travels out from their culture, or they feel that they're sufficiently protected, which in fact we've seen in that the military that have caused tremendous atrocities in Argentina and Chile and El Salvador and the list is endless, have not in fact been tried or executed in the same fashion. So this is a it's a strange thing about both, on one end, the photographer feeling the necessity to make the image, the person in the image in a strange way collaborating by the fact that they don't prevent the image from being made, though they're not giving permission per se. They certainly could make it impossible at times. And we also know of places that have been wise enough, such as to prevent the images because they believe in the power of them, whether it be Israel or South Africa, where it is absolutely forbidden to make such documents.
Do you have photographs that took on lives of their own in the countries that you shot them and took on lives very different than the ones you had envisioned?
The film documents an image that has had an extensive life of its own, and I think a surprising one, the man throwing the Molotov in the town of Esteli at the last day before Somoza left the country during the insurrection. I mean, it's an image that's very heroic. It's been stenciled on the walls in Nicaragua. It's been seen on the covers and inside pages of many magazines internationally. And it was also a symbol that was Xeroxed and used by the Contras to raise funds against the Sandinistas, accusing them of communist aggression. I think anyone who makes an image has learned, perhaps painfully, that it can be Xeroxed and is never owned again. The image exists, and I find parts of images in paintings and other people's pictures, and we're about to enter an age of digitization in which it'll be that much easier to borrow a few pixels out of my picture and integrate it in someone else's picture. And what the original moment meant may be nothing in relation to how it in the future will be used.
You were in your early 30s when you first went to Central America, right?
I actually turned 30 in Nicaragua.
Okay.
In my first trip.
And now you're in your early 40s?
I'm in my early 40s.
Has your attitude toward risking your life for your work changed as you've gotten older?
I guess in some ways, but in some ways it's still the same. I mean, I'm here, it's 10 days before, whatever, Christmas, a little longer. I'm faced with a decision in the next 2 days as to whether or not I'm going to join a team of people who are going into an area which is going to be difficult. And it means giving up Christmas with my family and my friends, and it's an impossible decision. Not just because there's risk, but because if I make a decision that rather than be with them at Christmas, I will travel to a difficult area, they are less important than my work. The possibility of their anxiety that I inevitably create will cause them pain. My family's been fantastic, and as has been the man that I've lived with for a long time now. But it is not an easy thing to ask of anyone.
What is the place that you're thinking of going to?
I think it's, I prefer not to say, considering the conditions of the place I'm going.
You think it might put you at risk to mention?
Yeah, I do. I don't know. I think we can never know that.
So how are you going to decide whether or not to go?
I don't know, Terry. I don't know. I'm just going to be with myself for the next couple of days and see when I pull out the suitcase if it feels right to be packing it.
Right. When you went back to Nicaragua for your movie, you found that a lot of people felt, well, cheated by the revolution in a way. It is true that they no longer lived under threat of being killed by the National Guard, by Somoza's National Guard. On the other hand, materialistically, their lives hadn't really changed for the better. They were still poor, no food, or very little food, very little work, difficult to feed their children, shabby housing. When you look at what people told you and how disappointed they were and how so many of them had given up hope, do you blame that on the revolution? Do you think that the Sandinista leadership was unable to deliver? Or do you think it had more to do with the Contra War and with the difficulty of changing society for the better in Nicaragua while under attack by the Contras?
Terry, this is, to begin, I think that there's no question that the Sandinistas tried, and there's also no question that the war caused tremendous damage. You have to see that if a school's built and it's burned down, and if a clinic is built and it's burned down, there are only limited resources that one can work with. The people expected that they would no longer live on dirt floors, perhaps. But the fact that a sidewalk would be built along their road, or the road itself would be paved, wasn't enough. Nothing can be enough. I think the thing that's so difficult about change in the Third World, and Nicaragua is an example, is that what overthrowing the dictatorship may have taken a relatively short time compared, let's say, to what has been a war in El Salvador. The fact, though, is the reconstruction of a country, the resources that are needed to really transform it fundamentally to affect as many lives as it needs to, is incredibly difficult. I don't have any doubt that people will continue to fight for reforms, for in effect they've been fundamentally changed by what they did even 10 years ago. No one in the film, for example, denied and regretted per se that they had fought against Somoza. I think, are disappointed that their lives haven't been benefited materially. But again, I want to say one thing that you glided over, and it's perhaps the film doesn't make it sufficiently evident, but when Dionisio says the fact that the National Guard is no longer there and he's no longer terrified and that he can live at peace, we say that easily because we never lived with something fundamentally different than that, or we haven't yet lived in what is a state of tremendous repression. It's not a small thing.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to say that it was.
Yeah, I mean, it is an enormously significant thing. But that's not to say that there isn't tremendous disappointment that, as was said in the film again, that in some way their lives weren't better.
Well, Susan Micellis, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you the best.
Yeah, thanks, Terry.
Susan Micellis' new documentary film about Nicaragua is called Pictures from a Revolution. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk to filmmaker Paul Schrader about the dramatic use of physical violence and psychological violence. Schrader wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, and he directed Patty Hearst. His latest film, The Comfort of Strangers, is now out on video. And now that the Soviet Union no longer exists, Soviet emigre David Gurevich tells us what it's like to be without a country. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A federal appeals court in Atlanta has ruled that the federal government can send several thousand Haitian boat people back home. By a vote of 2-1, the appeals court turned aside a preliminary injunction issued in Miami that had blocked deportation of the Haitians now held on board ship and at a U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Advocates for the Haitians say that they face danger if forced to go home, while the U.S. government argues that most are economic refugees that could lead to a rush of people that the U.S. cannot handle. Attorneys say that they will appeal to the full circuit court and to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says that the Bush administration is taking seriously a new Washington Post ABC News poll that shows President Bush's approval rating has dropped to 47%. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The new approval rating is the lowest during the Bush administration. The poll also shows that 9 of 10 people polled said the economy is not so good or poor. In the past, administration officials have dismissed polls, but today Fitzwater said the poll reflects Americans' anxiety with the future. When the economy is in trouble, he said, people have a right to be concerned. Fitzwater also said the economy is still in a recession-like situation. The remark contradicts President Bush's earlier statements that the U.S. economy is technically no longer in recession. The spokesman said, we're taking these numbers to heart, and that the White House's own surveys confirm the Washington Post ABC News poll. Fitzwater said the administration will do all it can to turn the economy around. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Also in Washington, the Social Security Administration has announced that new regulations, which take effect tomorrow, will mean that more persons infected with the AIDS virus will qualify for disability benefits sooner. Advocates worry that new restrictions contained in the rules will have a discriminatory effect on women and the poor. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
Four new conditions or illnesses, including advanced cervical cancer, have been added to a list of diseases that will automatically qualify people infected with HIV for disability benefits and federal health insurance. People with Kaposi sarcoma, however, will no longer automatically qualify for benefits. They, along with people who have meningitis, tuberculosis, and other illnesses, must prove their disease is disabling. Secretary of Health and Human Services Louis Sullivan says the new measures will make it easier for people infected with HIV to get their benefits faster. But advocates for the HIV-infected poor and women contend that their clients will still have difficulty meeting the new requirements. They question why the agency did not simply broaden the list of illnesses that would automatically qualify people for assistance. For National Public Radio, I'm Brenda Wilson.
This is NPR News. In Washington, the Israeli delegation to the Middle Eastern peace talks says that it will head for home tomorrow after one last meeting. It appears now that the talks are deadlocked over procedural matters. All sides at the talks have stuck to their hardline positions, and there appears no indication of compromise. Earlier, President Bush called on all parties to get past their differences on procedures and get down to basics. A Nebraska restaurant chain, partially owned by Democratic presidential candidate Bob Kerry, has been cited for violations of federal child labor laws. For member station KCUR in Kansas City, Ken Miller reports.
The U.S. Department of Labor's regional office in Kansas City announced today that the Grandmother's Restaurant chain has been cited for 116 child labor law violations. Department officials say the violations are not unusual, and other restaurants in Nebraska were also cited. Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry founded the Grandmother's chain, which has 7 locations in Lincoln and Omaha. Labor Department spokeswoman Norma Conrad says the violations involve children under the age of 16.
The basic types of violations involved hours worked and the times of day and or night that these young people were working.
Conrad says the restaurant chain has been fined about $65,000 for the violations. Kerry and the chain's other owners can appeal the citations. For National Public Radio, I'm Ken Miller.
According to the UCLA Business Forecasting Project, California's current recession will not end until at least late next year. The study found that non-farm employment in the state will move down 3.2% this year and 1.3% next year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 17 points. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Paul Schrader wrote the screenplays for several provocative, well-known films like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ. And he directed some provocative, lesser-known films like Blue Collar, Hardcore, Mishima, and Patty Hearst. Schrader's latest movie, The Comfort of Strangers, is now out on video. It's based on a novel by Ian McEwan. The screenplay was written by Harold Pinter. The story is about a British couple on vacation in Venice who fall under the spell of an older, charming yet sinister couple. The younger couple is seduced by the older couple's sadomasochistic fantasies. The younger couple is played by Natasha Richardson and Rupert Everett. The older couple is played by Christopher Walken and Helen Mirren. Schrader told me what interested him in The Comfort of Strangers.
Not so much the story as the characters, you know, and the morality. You know, it is not, you know, as they say in Hollywood, it is not story-driven. It is character-driven. And it is just saturated with the moral and sexual ambiguity of behavior, and any of the characters can be read in a number of ways, and I love that. In life, and I love that in art.
Christopher Walken and Helen Mirren play an older couple, and he's the son of an Italian diplomat living in an elegant house, and you could tell right away there's something very unsavory about him, and you could tell right away that there's something very sadistic about him. And although the younger couple doesn't much like him, it kind of ignites this attraction to each other, and they end up making love for days. Do you think that it's dangerous to flirt with danger?
I like that slip of the tongue, making up love.
Is that what I said?
You asked if I thought it was dangerous.
To flirt with danger.
Well, yes, but it's fun.
Now you worked with a script by Harold Pinter. How would you characterize his screenwriting?
Well, to characterize his screenwriting, you have to back up to his playwriting in general. You know, and the innovation that Harold brought to the theater 30 years ago was this notion that indirection in dialogue is just another form of direction, and that if a character doesn't talk about a thing long enough, he ends up talking about it. Or, to use another metaphor, you can look at a rock long enough and you will see the bugs underneath. You don't actually have to pick it up. So he often writes dialogue that seems to be meandering, seems to be repetitive, seems to be almost an incantation. But it is very much to a point, and the point is language itself as a mask.
Now, what does that leave you to do as the director? Are there things that you have to put in visually that are not in the script because of the kind of elliptical writing that he does?
Yeah, well, first of all, he has no descriptions in the script. You know, it's, you know,
it's just the dialogue.
Interior room, and then you go to the dialogue. So everything that is on screen has to be imagined. And then you have to decide how aggressive a player the camera is in the drama. If you have a scene with two people talking, there's always three people in the scene because there's the two people who are talking and then there's the third person who's watching them. And how active or passive that person is who is watching them is a directorial decision. Most films like to pretend that the third person is not present, so they hide the presence of the camera. In this case, I decided to go the other way and make the audience always aware of the drifting, voyeuristic, sometimes bored mind of the camera, of the voyeur watching the drama. And I felt that the story was so, shall we say, kind of perverse or morbid, and the humor was so kind of dark that I had to mask it in glamour. You know, it's like if someone gives you a particularly rotten apple and you have to go sell it. You know, well, you shine it up and really cosmeticize it, and hopefully someone buys it and thinks it's so beautiful that until they bite into it and find their mouth full of worms and maggots. And I guess that's how I decided to treat the story and the language and to lend a kind of dreamlike floating glamour to it.
We know at the beginning of the movie, I was really wondering what you were doing because it seems so unlike you. The beginning of the movie is, you know, a beautiful sunset, gorgeous scenes of Venice. And it's almost, European in the sense, you know, the kind of European film that has, like, beautiful, elegant images, and it's kind of boring. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I think that if there is something that distinguishes European and American cinema, it's not the beauty of the image, because Americans make extremely beautiful films as well. It's the priority that is set on plot versus character. And I think the Europeans are a little more comfortable letting the drama rest with the character and the theme, so that when the story is not being driven with the impact of a Hollywood film, you do have more time to absorb the beauty of the cinematography, and therefore you think it is more beautiful.
But here's what I think I was getting to, that in the beginning scenes, I was thinking that this is a much more high art interpretation of beauty, you know, elegant sunsets, beautiful architecture, Venice, which kind of signifies European, as opposed to, with the exception of Mishima, you're usually very kind of American subject matter, and you're much more kind of colloquial approach to it.
Well, it's also, I did a film, American Gigolo, which has all of that you know, arty-farty junk in it, too.
My guest is screenwriter and director Paul Schrader. His latest film, The Comfort of Strangers, has just been released on home video. Schrader also wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, and he directed American Gigolo, Hardcore, Mishima, and Patty Hearst. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is screenwriter and director Paul Schrader. The latest film he directed is The Comfort of Strangers, which is now out on video. To give you an idea of how eccentric yet oddly seductive the Christopher Walken character is, here's one of his monologues.
We children were again alone in the house. Nanny was away. My youngest sisters, Alice and Lisa, came to me in the garden. They say, Robert, Robert, come to the kitchen quickly. Ava and Maria have a treat for you. I was suspicious, but I went. I was so innocent. On the kitchen table were two big bottles of lemonade, cream cake, two packets of cooking chocolate, a big box of marshmallows. And Maria said, look, darling, this is all for you. But first, Ava said, you must drink some medicine. This is very rich food, and this medicine will protect your stomach. Help you to enjoy it. I was too greedy to question this. I drank the medicine, only slightly disgusting. Then I ate the chocolate and the marshmallow and the cake and drank a bottle of lemonade. They applauded and said that only a man could drink a second bottle of lemonade. It would be beyond my capabilities. I said, give it to me. And I drank the second bottle. And I finished the chocolate and the marshmallows and the cake. And they said, bravo, bravo. Then the kitchen began to spin round me. And I badly needed to go to the lavatory. Suddenly, Eva and Maria held me down and tied my hands together with a long piece of rope behind my back and dragged me into my father's study. They took the key from the inside, slammed the door and locked it. Bye, bye, Robert, they called through the keyhole. Now, you are Big Papa. In his study, I was locked in. My revered, my feared father's study, where he received the Diplomatic Corps of London, the elite of the world, and I puked and pissed and shat all over my father's carpets and walls. My father found me there. He said, Robert, have you been eating chocolate? Then he nearly killed me. Then he didn't speak to me for 6 months. I've never forgiven my sisters.
Christopher Walken is, as far as I'm concerned, an actor we don't get to see enough of in American films. And tell me what you saw in him when you cast him for this role. I think he's just terrific at embodying a certain kind of menace.
Well, the criterion for casting that role was the character has a 10-minute speech.
Right.
And he gives it in a seated position. And that is simply an acting discipline and ability that very few actors possess. And, you know, Chris is one of those actors. So I would have preferred the actor to be more Italian, you know. Unfortunately, both Pacino and De Niro were working at the time, and those were the only other two actors I could think of. But then I very quickly got to Chris, who was available, because I knew he could do this, and I'd seen him do it on stage. And in fact, all four actors, which is Natasha Richardson, Rupert Everett, and Helen Mirren, all of them have a lot of stage experience because I needed actors who could read a line in more than one way, who could shade and flavor a line as the conversation progressed, rather than actors who simply give up themselves in the same way every time.
I want to talk with you a little about the subject of violence. Violence as a release, as a form of release or even redemption, is a kind of recurrent image in movies that you've directed and written. And I would use Taxi Driver as an example and The Comfort of Strangers as another. And I'm wondering, I mean, I could ask this more on an abstract level, but I'm wondering on just a physical level, if you were ever the victim of violence or participated in any violence yourself, or if your interest in it is, you know, much more intellectual.
Well,
metaphorical interest.
Yeah, but also psychological. You know, I'm something of a claustrophobe. I'm not nearly as bad as I used to be. But that sense of being trapped, of being caught, and of having to strike out to save your life, you know, sort of permeates my psychology. I haven't really participated in violence, and I don't particularly enjoy going to violent movies. And to be honest, I don't particularly make them. You know, in my entire career, I've killed fewer people than Bruce Willis has in 5 minutes. What I do traffic in is psychological violence, which is, in fact, much more oppressive than cartoon violence. So even though there aren't many bodies and there aren't many gun hits and there isn't much blood, there is a feeling of violence, you know, particularly like the first film I directed, Blue Collar. It just radiates violence and tension, even though it's not a violent movie. So to some degree, I've been unfairly stuck in that violence box, and I think that's wearing off now, though.
But when you do have a violent scene, it really counts for something, and there is this sense of release. You feel like everything's been building to this all along.
Yeah, well, I like that thing in Japanese art, you know, which is it goes in through all the arts, Japan, and singing, and painting, and calligraphy. You know, it's repression, 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 and then all of a sudden, boom, explosion. You know, and the rapid shift from holding back to letting go, which is a mark of Japanese art, is one that I share.
Do you think that the repression that you went through as a child, because you came from a very strict fundamentalist upbringing where there was so much that you weren't allowed to do, do you think that that contributed to your interest in that sensibility of repression?
Well, if it walks like a duck and looks like a duck, maybe it is a duck.
All right. what do you think your reputation is now in the movie industry?
That's a nice question. I think I'm kind of make it his own way filmmaker who is respected and given some slack on the cusp, you know, because that's where I am. I'm sort of on the cusp of the industry. But, you know, if you understand the industry, you also know that people who finance films know better than the public how close the circumference of the economic circle is to the locus, and that the man who made Eraserhead can make Elephant Man 2 years later, you know, so that being on the cusp of the industry doesn't mean being out of the industry.
Do you find that the kind of movie that you want to make changes as you get older, either the subject or the style?
Yes, of course. And, you know, that anger thing goes, you know, the thing of the 20s, you know, I'm going to force my way into this world and I'm going to make them put up with me. And then they do put up with you, and so that calms down. You know, I have two children, a house in the suburbs. You know, anxiety starts to replace anger. The themes do change.
Paul Schrader, his latest film, The Comfort of Strangers, is now out on video. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Lots of news tonight. Also, NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports on the campaign of Bill Clinton, governor of Arkansas, now running for the presidency. Brett Weston, the photographer, now 80 years old, has burned all of his negatives from a life's work. He did that much to the consternation of many in the world of photography. Also, we'll talk with Joe Burke, the producer of the reading of Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, by Mr. White himself, on tape and now on CD. Mr. Burke talks about the experience of going to Maine back in 1970 and recording the book. E.B. White said he was reluctant to appear on the tape, but he didn't want anyone else to be the voice of Charlotte's Web.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Boris Yeltsin and Mikhail Gorbachev have agreed to dissolve the Soviet Union within the next 2 weeks, and Gorbachev's hold on power seems to be disappearing along with the Soviet Union. Commentator David Gurevich is a Soviet emigre who left Russia in 1976. He has these thoughts.
I can't go out these days without someone asking me, how does it feel to be from a country that no longer exists? In itself, it's no catastrophe, I tell them. First, I'm a true blue American citizen. I'm worried about the IRS, not the KGB. Second, the change has not happened overnight. Things have been moving in that direction for 5 years by now. All right, they say. What about Gorbachev? What's he going to do now? Ah, Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev. That's another matter. I must say, I've always been in two minds about him. His entire career was a steady climb of a functionary, loyally towing the party line, being ruthless to subordinates, and obedient with superiors. When I was in Russia, I saw his kind only on TV, on top of Lenin's mausoleum. Otherwise, I felt their presence when Moscow police stopped all the traffic so that one of their long black limos could rush past their humble subjects without giving us a thought. With that in mind, how could I share American media's mindless Gorbomania? But then strange things began to happen. Russian people were actually opening their mouths, shyly at first, but then more and more boldly. Then East European puppet governments fell like dominoes, and not one Soviet tank was ordered into action. I've tried hard to be skeptical about Gorbachev's part in it. I knew the economic situation was so bad that the Soviets simply could not afford to police Europe anymore. When I went back to Russia in 89, I found a groundswell of anti-Gorbachev feeling that was far more intense than Western Gorbomania. Wait a minute, I cried. Isn't it Gorbachev who ultimately let you get away with all this criticism? I suddenly found myself defending him. But the Russians were not mollified. Some wanted to put the gas pedal to the floor and race into Western democracy. Others wanted to make a U-turn and go back to Brezhnev's or even Stalin's days when there was still sausage in the stores. Few people gave a damn about the Berlin Wall. But it was not until I met my father after 15 years away that I understood something. He was crushed by all the revelations about the injustices of the past that filled Soviet papers. His entire world, where a shining communist future was right around the corner, if we just work a little harder, comrade, his world was falling apart. Through him, I understood Gorbachev, whose world was also falling apart, and he was the one who picked the first rock out of its foundation. He must have been surprised. All he wanted to do was to remodel. Blinded by his own ideology, he did not realize that the house that Lenin built was a house of cards. Well, are we all such great architects? I see him now on TV, fidgeting, muttering, evading reporters' eyes, evading their questions, a shadow of the Gorby who only a few years ago would stop his limo in Times Square to kiss babies and shake hands. I feel for him. You know the line, the last person to leave would please turn off the light? How would you feel if you were that person? He's not a visionary. He's just a man who tried to do some good. He's not leaving his job a happy man, but leave he must. Just like his entire generation must give room to the next one, unbound by the communist dogma. The world of Gorbachev and my father was an unfair one, but for them to see it thrown out onto the scrap heap of history is a drama of an entire generation. And now that no communist secretary can deny me or anybody a right to speak out, a right to have a job, a right to do what I want with my life, I think maybe I can afford some sympathy for these people.
David Gurevich is the author of From Lenin to Lenin. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Joan Tuohy, Sue Spolin, and Roberta Shurrock, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, gender-bending movies. We talk with Pedro Almodovar, the director of Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, and the new film, High Heels. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.